So this evening, we would like to follow the theme and to think about walking with God in the darkness. And I want to address point A about the thick darkness where God was. And he has made me walk in darkness rather than light, and this idea of lighting our own fires. And then Sandra will be speaking to us about the treasures of darkness. The thought there that we see there is this idea that's expressed in Exodus 20. And I must say that though I'd read these verses before, I hadn't really sort of stopped to think about them in terms of the darkness where God was. And it just talks about, it says in verse 21, "The people remained at a distance while Moses approached the thick darkness where God was." And as I was alerted to this theme in an article that I read, and then this article and other passages that I read drew my attention to this in a way that I hadn't noticed before. And you also see it in Genesis 15, where God gives a very special revelation to Abraham and the covenant. I think Bishop Collins spoke about this at one of the services that I was at recently, and there was this deep darkness in which God revealed himself. And then you also see it right in the beginning of Exodus, that when God sort of makes his presence visible to the people of Israel, there's a cloud by day and fire by night. And so the visible expression, most of the time you might say when they were looking, was the cloud in the daytime. And then also when the glory of God filled the tabernacle, and when the glory of God filled the temple, it was also made visible in a cloud. And that Israel obviously associated darkness as part of their understanding of God. And then also the Holy of Holies, which was the most sacred place of God, was shrouded in darkness. The seven-stick candle was actually outside. And when the priest went in there once a year, there was some reflected light that went into it, but it was basically a dark place. And I think what I realize is that I've sort of grown up, you might say, in New Testament Christianity with the idea that God is light and in him is no darkness at all, which is quite true. But it's like there's a broader picture which extends into the Old Testament. And even in the New Testament, as I began to think about this a little bit more, it says God who dwells in unapproachable light. And so there was the understanding was coming that actually God is trying to say something to us about this subject of darkness. And also I was thinking of another place of darkness where we might meet God is in what the AV called the closet. You know, where it says, when you pray, enter into your closet. I don't know what kind of closets they had in Israel, but it was clearly a dark and a quiet place, a place where one withdrew. And through this study, I felt that I received a more, you might say, a more complete or more balanced picture of God. And I think it also reflected on that what I considered the normal Christian life is a life of daytime all the time. And even as day has night and darkness, I saw that it's quite normal for the Christian life to have light and darkness in it. And darkness isn't totally a negative word. And I think that we have this idea, you know, that everything should be bright and cheerful, and anything that is sad and depressing is somehow not to be embraced, and it's abnormal, and it's meant to be avoided. I sometimes think that one of the trends, I think, a little bit, is like when somebody dies, they have a celebration. Well, I can see the point, you know, you want to celebrate someone's life, but I was just glancing through Acts, and it says they deeply mourned at Stephen's death. They didn't organize a celebration. And I thought, because that's the natural reaction when someone dies. You might say it's a normal part of life. And another verse that I realized that I had read and studied quite a few years ago came back into my memory, and that's in Hebrews chapter 12. And that's worth just having a look at. I don't like to sort of have you sort of flipping through the Bible, you know, and showing your neighbor that you don't know where these books are, and as sometimes happens to me. And so in 12, we have this very interesting chapter 12, Hebrews, looking at verse 18, starting at verse 18, and it says, "You have not come to a mountain that can be touched, and that is burning with fire, to darkness, gloom, and storm, to a trumpet blast, or to such a voice speaking words, that those who heard it begged that no further word be spoken to them, because they could not bear what was commanded. If even an animal touches the mountain, it must be stoned. The sight was so terrifying that Moses said, 'I am trembling with fear.'" It says, "But you have come to Mount Zion, to the heavenly Jerusalem, to the city of the living God. You have come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly." And this verse really waxes eloquent. And it was David Pawson, commenting on this verse, said that our experience of God determines our view of Him. And now that view may not be correct, or that view may not be complete. And so what he was bringing out, that our New Testament experience was of coming to Jesus, the light of the world, God made manifest. And, you know, the smile on the face, as it were. And the happiness and the joy. And this is all quite appropriate. But it isn't that in this passage that the author says, you used to, or that you have not come to some idolatry, but now you come to Christ. He says, you haven't come to an Old Testament experience that nevertheless is very real and has something to say to us. And I think the consequence of this is that possibly we are somewhat over-familiar with God. And in a sense, we can't help it. But we need to understand that there's more to God than just one particular aspect of His character, or even in His person of Jesus, that there are other aspects of God, like His holiness, for example, and how unapproachable He can be in the rest of the Scriptures. I hope this is not confusing you, because I don't want to say that there's sort of contradiction here, but there's a completeness. And I think that it might be difficult for us to get our minds around it because we don't talk about the other part of it. We are New Testament Christians. But it isn't a different God in the New Testament than in the Old Testament. And so I was thinking that the God who dwells in darkness may have something to reveal that we need to hear. And we might need to dare, as it were, to enter the darkness. We might need to enter the closet, or where, however the analogy would be used, to hear what He would say, so that, in a sense, we can offer Him the worship that's acceptable. Because this passage enters with a very interesting verse. It says in the last verse of this chapter, "Let us be thankful and so worship God acceptably with reverence and awe, for our God used to be, but no longer is, a consuming fire." No, it doesn't say that. It says our God is a consuming fire. And so we need to be aware of that. And I feel that should honor, in a sense, where some of these ideas came from. This is not a magazine that I'm particularly acquainted with, Anglican Renewal, but I think some of you are. And Michael Milton says this, Mitten, yeah, my writing. "It is my sense that many charismatics in the Western world are being led into this wilderness place to learn about darkness where God is. Charismatics," and I don't think they're only charismatics, "charismatics have on the whole often been found at the places of light, of power, of high praise, and for reasons I've never quite fathomed, a frantic busyness." And then, and I don't smile sort of in any condescending way. And then he says, "From time to time, God will need to woo us into the darkness, to use the language of Hosea. It is here," he's talking about wooing, God taking Israel to roar in the wilderness. And that's a desert place. And it says, it is here that we may discard our clutter and defenses and meet with our God, who desires to love us and speak tenderly to us. It is here that we may encounter the darkness where God is. And he goes on to say some very interesting things. And so I have to say these were some quite new discoveries, but they rang true because the broad perspective of Scripture did seem to agree with it. And so that aspect of God, I was very blessed by the thick darkness where God is. And then I sort of want to go on to a slightly different theme if we go to Lamentations. And I feel it's better looking at it in this way because it kind of sets a context to it. Lamentations 3, verse 2. You understand, I only need these glasses, not because I have trouble with my sight, but because the light isn't very good in this room. It says in verse 2, he has driven me away. Is it? Okay, good. Well, for anyone that's struggling, it's Lamentations after Jeremiah. Do find it if you can, because it is a passage we're going to be referring to tomorrow as well. And it says there that he made me walk in darkness rather than light. Indeed, he has turned his hand against me again and again all day long. And then it says, he has made my skin and my flesh grow old and broken my bones. He has besieged me and surrounded me. And then I read this passage, and it says, he has walled me in. He has barred my way. He dragged me from the path and mangled me. He drew his bow. He pierced my heart. He has filled me with bitter herbs. And I realized as I read this passage, though I'd probably read it for many, many times, because I do read the Bible through regularly, I realized that this was saying something that I hadn't really heard before. And I remember when I discovered this, I sort of photocopied it and sent it out in my newsletter and was sort of saying that I had to realize that this also was part of Christian experience, as hard as I may find it to accept or to cope with that idea. And of course, it's not only Jeremiah. This is probably Jeremiah, though we don't know for sure. Job says, I go to the east, and he is not there. I go to the west, I do not find him. When he is at work in the north, I don't know if he means Manchester, I don't see him when he turns to this. When he turned to the south, I catch no glimpse of him. And we're very familiar, of course, with Psalm 139. If I go to the heights and the depths, you know, God is there. And that's true as well. But what Job is talking about is, I don't see him. He might be there, but I don't see him. I don't sense him. And this is what I felt that I was experiencing something of. The context of this passage in Lamentations is that probably Jeremiah was a good man in an alien environment under God's judgment. And because of the pain, he couldn't see. And as you know, if this was Jeremiah, he'd probably have been put in a pit. We know the story, don't we, about how that he put in a pit and it was just so deep in mud that he sank into it. And that wasn't the only time that this had happened to him. I remember when when Mandy was just a little girl, I'd had an experience where there was kind of like a temporary, looked like a temporary deliverance, and then it got worse. And Mandy, it was so touching that she shared, you know, Dad, you're just experiencing the things, you remember that, don't you? That Jerry, I think he's about 8 or 9. You think you're just experiencing things like Jeremiah. He was in a pit and he was taken out, but then he was put back in it. And she was seeking to comfort me with those words, but I was comforted because of the genuineness with which they were shared. And as I say, these verses came to me in the time of dialysis. Now, you heard our testimony about the time of dialysis. And I think what I would say, in the first experience, or the first 4 years of dialysis, I really did see God's love in people. And it was a deep impact. I think the second time, the way I began to see it, was that the pain was so severe, I couldn't see anything. and that I couldn't, for sure, I couldn't see God. Because I think the way that I experienced it was, for example, dialysis. How do you explain dialysis? Some people said, you know, do you feel sort of cleaned up? You know, you sort of had your blood purified. And I said, no, I don't usually feel too good. And I think what it began to be for me was like getting beat up three times a week. That experience was like being beat up, and I thought I really should have had some kind of like post-traumatic stress counseling or something like that, because I was just getting hit and hit and hit. And I was depressed. I remember going to see the doctor, and the doctor said to me, "You seem depressed. Do you want to talk about it?" I said, "No," because I thought, what can you do? You know, I don't need somebody to talk to. I need deliverance, and you can't do anything for me. So she probably thought, boy, this guy really is depressed. But I was, and I remember talking about later to the doctor that not only was I depressed the medical profession. Because the doctor said to me later, he said, when we used to see you coming, we sort of, you know, sort of, it's him, oh dear, what are we going to do for him? We don't know what we can do for him. We can't do anything for him. And I used to read the Bible every day. That is sort of one of the advantages of being Christian work. Even if I wasn't in Christian work, I wouldn't have been working. So I'd read the Bible every day. And I was wasting my time, you might say. Because, I mean, I did get these thoughts out of it. That's one thought I got out of it. But at lunchtime, I couldn't tell you what I'd read. And it was like one of the things with dialysis is that rather than some of the impurities stay in your blood, and your blood, of course, affects your mind. So your mind is affected. So in a sense, you're not even in a mental state to be able to take anything in. And that there really was this feeling over these 4 years that if it could go wrong, it would go wrong. And in fact, I'm not going to do this, but I wrote, just in my preparation, I wrote a list, or not a list, sort of, just one thing came to mind after the other. And as Sandra was telling you, you know, I had dialysis, and I had renal failure. And then, I can't believe this, I get cancer. Well, and as Sandra said, you know, when you're having an operation and you're not coming around again, you haven't eaten, and they want to dialyze you. And I'm saying, I don't need dialysis. I've not eaten anything. Well, you need it anyway because of certain chemical reactions in your body. And then I had that, so I'd wake up in the morning. I'm not going to go into this, but, you know, because when I did it, I started crying, and so I'm going to try and keep my composure. But it was just one thing after the other. And I think for the first time in my life, I really saw death on the horizon. And I'll tell you, it was attractive to me. Because I didn't want to live anymore. And there was this thing that they'd try and evaluate, you know, a kidney patient's quality of life and whether it's worth living. Well, they could have had my vote. It wasn't worth living. And I used to pray to God, and then I'd say, I'm tired of this shit life. Because that's what it was to me. And I just didn't know how I could go on. And then, as Sandra was telling you, you know, this transplant came. And it was, you know, sort of at last light. And that this transplant came and it worked immediately. And it was, I mean, you can imagine the joy and delight of when you've, well, the first thing that happened is my mind cleared. It was as if a scales fell from my mind. And for the first time I could think. But I'm no sooner coming around from the operation or my bladder seized up. And I can remember sort of sobbing away with this nurse that I was saying, you know, I can't take this anymore. You know, I've had a lot of pain. I just can't take this anymore. And the pain of that bladder that didn't work, so you can, I don't want to sort of go to too many chemical lessons here, but at first you're catheterized, and then they take the catheter out, and then it wouldn't work. It was blocked. And so then what happened? Your kidney's motoring along very nicely, producing urine, but it just stays in the bladder, and it wouldn't come out. And I remember that in the morning, in the evening when this started, you know, I was saying, you know, you need the nurse, you know, you need to do something about this. And I don't know why, but they didn't do anything. You know, doctor will come tomorrow. And I remember sitting on a commode all night, pressing it out by force so that some of the urine would come out. And I was so angry. I mean, I think before this time, people used to say to me, "Are you angry?" And I would say, "I don't think so. I feel more like a beaten dog that just hasn't got any spirit left to be angry." But I had a bit then. And I said, "What is the good of this?" And I have to laugh now because I made a defiant gesture to God that night. I watched a rude film on television. And it wasn't even erotic or anything, you know. But it was just my step of, you know, fighting back. It's madness, isn't it? But this is how I felt. And this problem was eventually healed. But I remember so clearly saying to God, "What is this for?" You know, because we're so educated as Christians, you know, everything works together for good. All right, well, what's the good of a blocked up bladder then? And I never got an answer on that. But I think God gave me some answers later on. And so I just wanted to share with you this, to share with you the intensity of the darkness that we can experience as a Christian. And that, you know, God does allow this. And I don't know about you, but I really hate wayside pulpits. Are you familiar with them? Maybe you love them. Maybe I'm offending somebody here tonight. There used to be one down in the corner of Parswood Road and Fog Lane. And it says, "If God seems far away, who moved?" And I thought, you just don't know. Actually, sometimes maybe God moved. Or at least he's there, but you don't realize it. And I feel these things sort of trivialize the reality of experience. I just want to put a postscript on it. This was my experience. I experienced severe darkness. It doesn't always happen. I have a delightful story of a very close friend of ours who's had cancer, Jill Wright. And she, when she was at the deepest point, she had a most marvelous visitation of Christ, didn't she? I don't know the details, but doesn't she say he came into the room and he kind of sat on her bed, didn't he? And he talked to her.
She just saw him,
didn't she? And you know, it was kind of like it gave her such courage and strength, doesn't it? So I feel I need to say that kind of as a postscript. So I don't want to give the impression that this is everybody's experience when they have ill health or something like that. But I wanted to sort of tune you into, as it were, what can happen, and also what follows has a lot to do with this. And so then the next thing I'd like to address is this lighting fires. It's in Isaiah 50, verse 3. And this is another verse. I suppose the only couple of thoughts I ever had in those 4 years was the one about he has made me walk in darkness rather than light. And the second one was this thought of lighting your own fires. And it says in Isaiah 50, "Who among you fears the Lord and obeys the word of his servant? Let him who walks in the dark, who has no light, trust in the name of the Lord and rely on his God. But now all of you who light fires and provide yourselves flaming torches, go walk in the light of your fires." And so I was intrigued by this idea that what does it mean to sort of, you're in darkness and you want to light your own fire. And in fact, I was sharing these things with David just shortly after this. And he says, you know, what do you think it means, this lighting your own fires? And to be truthful, I don't know if I articulated it then, but it made me very much think about what is lighting your own fires when it's dark. And I think that if you look at this passage, there's walking in darkness and having faith, or it's lighting your own darkness and making your situation bright artificially in an unreal way. And so I thought, well, it really has this idea of faith versus sight. You know, we believe in whom we have not seen. And so a couple of sort of torches or flames came to me as I was kind of thinking about it. I think the thing that I did notice at that time was that people light the fire or the escape of denial and not facing reality. And I remember I saw this the first time I was in the hospital in 1976, that there was this whole range of people on this ward. And it was interesting to see how they cope with dialysis. You know, remember one guy was sort of mind over matter, you know, and he was enthusiastic and he was going to learn how to work with his kidney machine. And, you know, he was going to cope with this. He wasn't going to let this get him down. But others, they sort of pretended it wasn't happening. And so they wouldn't stick to their diet. And, you know, two or three other people of that original group died. And one of the ones that died, you might say, was in the denial category. He wouldn't accept that if he was going to live, he had to respond to this kind of regime. And I think Christians have something about this, that they don't want to connect with pain. I have a friend who has some relatives who lost a child. And it, on the surface, it didn't faze them. They kept on rejoicing and they kept on praising. And it was as if they'd never lost this child. And everybody watching them is totally amazed because they have not connected with their feelings of loss. And the chickens will come home to roost on that. And one of the discoveries was that I made during this time that being a Christian is not an anesthetic. And that I feel pain the same way as that guy who positively dislikes God who's next to me. That when I insert a needle into my arm, it hurts me and it hurts him. And there's no kind of easing of that because I'm a Christian. I think you might say, I would say to honor God, to be truthful, that God helps to endure. But it's not like to endure in the sense that I feel it less than him. And so I've noticed that, I don't know, because for some reason that people want to deny, and sometimes they want to deny it for you as well, that it couldn't possibly be that bad because you're a Christian. And then the other thing that I've observed is that some people escape into worship. And sometimes I think... I was looking at Job's praise in the deepest point of his life. And it says this, "At this, Job got up and tore his robe, shaved his head, fell on the ground in worship and said, I'm so happy and here's the reason." No, he didn't do that, did he? But is this some... That's a favorite 50s chorus for anyone who doesn't know it. You see, his worship was on his knees and in pain. And I sometimes think I can't relate to some people because their lives are in a mess, and then it's as if they flip, I can't understand what takes place because I notice that, I mean, it's just a gut reaction thing that I kind of feel I see something and it's not life, it's not real, it's not worship that's somehow rooted in reality, but it's like, you know, a weekly fix that people sometimes experience at church to kind of, you know, it's another form of denial, I think. It's not facing the pain because it's just too painful to think about it. And I think that, you know, God doesn't mind if we feel pain as we worship. You know, that Job is a great example in that. But the thing that I loved about him was that he was so real in his worship. He could have really cursed God, but he still worshiped. But he worshiped, I suppose, that the image that I have is, you know, that I'm not a hand raiser, I have to admit, so... You know, but this is the hand-raising that I think he did. Because that's sort of like a Middle Eastern posture of prayer, isn't it? And I don't kneel, I don't raise my hands, I don't do either of them as physically so much. But I think it communicates to me something of the reality of worship with humility and honoring God and looking to God. And so I noticed that's a torch that people light. And then the other thing that I notice is that people, when you're in darkness, they come along and they want to little strike a match for you. They want to bring a little bit of light into your situation. One of the favorites, of course, of Christian light bearers is look on the bright side. And we had some experiences of that. People, I remember, used to come into my kidney room and say, isn't this great, you know, this kidney machine, and sort of thank God for science, you know. And if I wasn't such a kind person, I would have thought, well, if you like it, why don't you try it? In fact, I did think that. And Sandra one day was walking down the street and someone from church came and said, isn't wonderful that Dirk's got a kidney machine? And that lady's still alive, but only, I don't know why, Sandra's good grace. But this is the sort of, the, I call it, it's not lighting a fire, it's just striking a match, and it doesn't really help. And then the other match that I notice people strike is that, you know, all things work together for good. And that somehow this is supposed to bring you some cheer in your darkness. And I used to feel, I don't know if it does, but if it does, I don't want it. I don't care enough to want good to come out of this. This is too painful. And then when I looked around and saw the tragedies of life, I don't know what to make of these things. Just during, when I was on dialysis, I remember there was just in a very short time, there was two news things that came out. And one was that in South Africa, a gunman, you may remember this, had broken into that church and killed a lot of people. And then I remember hearing quite shortly after that how the church was marvelously revitalized, and it really upset me. And the reason was not because that wasn't true, because the way it was shared was somehow, it covered it. It didn't matter. It was good. Good come out of it. And I thought, what about the mother that is bringing up a child on her own? What about the poverty that's going to come if a breadwinner is lost in the situation? And it just didn't ring true. And then around the same time, there was a program, I think it was about suffering. And the only bit that I read was, the bishop says it's good for you. And I thought, I've come across that so many times, just watching Songs of Praise. I think it was last week, Christian Bernard was talking, and he said that was his father's philosophy. That's why he could cope, because, you know, suffering was good for you. And he said, it's not my experience. And I don't think he was speaking as a believer, and I didn't agree what he said after that. But I think saying that kind of thing, or bringing that kind of light in, is a bit like what the Scriptures talks about when it's singing songs to the weary. And what it does, it makes it darker. Because it makes your feeling of deprivation even greater, because you don't feel as if it's doing you any good. And so, in fact, it makes the situation worse. And so I think the feeling that sometimes people have is, you know how when you have a cold shower, you feel, you know, that was hard, but it was good. Or if you do some exercise, your muscles are aching lightly, and, you know, you feel good for a little bit of pain. Well, you know, I think maybe that bit of pain is good for you. But when it goes deeper than that, I think it's quite a different story. But I can understand how people might think that. So I've said a lot of things, and some of them, I suppose, have been a little bit controversial, not always that easy. But in a sense, the truth of the matter is that out of the darkness, treasures did come. And when I think about treasures of darkness, I think of, you know, that something that's found in a dark place. And what do you find in dark places? You find jewels, don't you? Jewels, diamonds formed under pressure in darkness, and that's what can happen as well. And I think not right away, but as we have had some perspective and some time, that there have been some treasure discovered, and Sandra's going to share about that.
Treasures of the darkness. I suppose it's different realizations about God that have come because of some of the things we've been through. And I think one of the biggest things is perhaps realizing that God is not fazed by my reactions. He can cope with my anger, my outrageous expressions, my disappointments. And it doesn't, perhaps it upsets him, but he's able to cope. And I think it is easy, like Dirk was saying, we can think that the only legitimate emotion as a Christian is joy. We want to be joyful, we sing joyful hymns. But there are other emotions that God has given us that are legitimate. And I found that I could come to God with all my emotions, with my fears, with my worries, with my disappointments, my anger. And I could come to him, and it was sort of in the darkness when I think about it. The times, for me, it helps to have my eyes closed when I come to God. And often it helps to be on my knees. And it was in this darkness, when everything else is shut out, that I found I could come to God when things were weighing me down, when I was worried about the future, when I was upset. It upset me seeing Dirk dialyse 3 times a week. I would, after dialysis, he would be very non-communicative. And it was very upsetting to see him like this. It never got easier, the 4 years, the second time particularly. And often I would just go to God and say, God, it's so hard. It's really hard to see him like this. And God, in that secret place, that dark place with my eyes closed, he was there. I think one of the treasures of going through a dark time is that you find out the things that matter most. And the things that mattered, seemed to matter most, were faith, that God was with us in it, even though it was difficult. My family mattered more than anything, my children, our relationship. Our friends mattered very much. And the other thing that mattered a lot was to have fun in the midst of all this, to try and bring some fun into our lives and enjoy the life that we did have. A lot of it was difficult, but there were days when Dirk was well, and it became very important to us to bring fun into those days that he was well, to do things together as a family, to go out, to enjoy life, to go shopping, to go to the theatre, whatever it was, to bring that fun into our life. It was also in that dark place when I was with God on my own at one time that after many months of struggling, it took me a long time initially when Dirk was ill, because I told you on Friday night I found it so hard to believe in God, that God loved us. And for months I struggled with this and struggled with what's happening to us. And I remember one time, after several months of this struggling, being alone with God and saying to him, God, what things can I be sure about in this life? And you've got a yellow paper, some of those things that I came out of that time are on that yellow paper. But I felt that God said to me during that time, there are things you can be sure about. And verses of scripture came into my mind. You can be sure of my presence with you always. I am with you always, even to the end of the world. That Jesus would be there. He promised that his grace would be sufficient, that my strength is made perfect in weakness. My grace is sufficient. And he would always provide our needs. My God shall supply all your needs. And I wrote down some of these things that I could be sure about. I would have liked to have added to that list that God would heal Dirk. I desperately wanted God to heal Dirk, but I felt that God was saying to me in that time, I can heal Dirk, but you have to leave that with me. You can't demand it. Mm-hmm. And keep asking, but don't demand. And I felt that brought me to some rest, that I couldn't have hung on to that, God is going to heal Dirk, because he has healed Dirk, but it took a long, long time. And it would have brought disappointment every day if I was constantly thinking God was going to heal him. I think God wanted us to live in that situation, to keep asking. Look, I think what I felt I could pray was, God, my heart's desire is that Dirk would be healed. But whatever is right, whatever is best for us, it's in your hands. And I felt this is where I had to be. Would you like to escape now? Escape through the window. I think the other treasure that's come out of the darkness that I can see now, which I couldn't see at the time, is the understanding that we've gained of other people that are in similar situations. There are certain things happened to me during that time. I think one of the things that happened to me was that I found it extremely difficult to commit myself to anything. I didn't get involved with anything at church except the home group that was a support to me. But I couldn't have committed myself to anything, because I was afraid I might let people down. I never knew what was going to happen, and I never knew how my emotions were going to be. And I couldn't commit myself to anything, and it's taken me a long time to be able to do that. Whenever, even now, if people say to me, Sandra, could you do this? I almost have a reaction. I can't do it. I can't commit myself. And it's gradually, I have been able to commit myself, like I'm involved in the mums group, which has brought me a lot of joy and friendship. But I couldn't commit myself. One of the other things that it may sound really strange, and it may sound very, very unspiritual, but I found it hard if people wanted to pray with me regularly. And John, I hope you don't mind mentioning this, but I know one time John asked, he wanted to help us, and he asked Dirk if he could come and pray with him regularly, and Dirk said no. And I don't know how John felt at that, about that reaction, but at the time I think it was because our pain was so intense that to come and pray regularly would have focused on the intensity of our pain. And what we'd needed was to know that people were praying for us. And that was great. But we needed to escape from the situation, and to pray with us just meant more intensity. And we couldn't cope with it. And I think I would have found that really hard to understand before we'd been through this. And I would have thought, oh, what's wrong with that person? Surely there's nothing wrong in praying with someone when they're in such difficulty. And maybe not everybody feels that. For some people it might be just what they need. But for us, it wasn't what we needed. We did need the assurance that people were praying for us. And an occasional prayer with us, if somebody visited us and they'd say, shall we just pray? That was fine. But anything regular was too intense. We couldn't bear it. All kinds of outward things seemed to help me at that time. It was very important to me to make sure I looked nice. This sounds very outward. But my physical appearance mattered a lot, that during all the difficulties I kept myself looking good, and it seemed to have some effect on my inner self if I thought I made the outside look reasonable. And so and it was important for me to go and buy a new dress occasionally, do something nice, just to take away from the intensity of things at home. making nice food for Dirk within his many restrictions was a challenge. But again, it was something physical that ministered. We very much appreciated when our friends took the effort of finding out about Dirk's diet and then invited us for a meal. Again, it took us away from our own situation.